Welcome and thank you so much for tuning into Psychology Is. We are on our 50th episode of this podcast, and that's a major milestone. And I kind of laugh at myself because I think there's been two other times where I said we were on our 50th episode, but I was just misremembering exactly how many we had published. So this time we really are on the 50th episode, and I'm joined by Jim Gottstein. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Yeah, we're pleased to have you. And you just fit perfectly in the theme of the topic we've been focusing on this podcast. And I have found myself saying this multiple times in recent episodes, but I want to acknowledge that I came into this creative collaboration, you know, with my friend Robert, with the intention to create, you know, entertaining, educational content. And then a podcast kind of emerged out of that. And the intention with the podcast was just to explore anything that I find to be extremely interesting and relevant. And so we've talked about a variety of topics within psychology, but I also have my personal interest and some degree of expertise related to the topic of the history and the modern practices and paradigms of psychiatry. That was something that I focused on in my dissertation research. And early in the podcast, we began talking to experts. Like, I think Robert Whitaker was like the fifth episode or so. So early on and often, we've been focusing in on this topic. And lately, we've really focused in on it. And I feel really good about that. It feels purposeful. It feels like conversations that need to be had and need to be publicized. And I just feel like we're at a point in time where we may just reach a critical mass of people who are aware and educated about the profound problems with the big picture related to modern psychiatry and the true harm that is being done in the world. And I just think, again, you fit really nicely because we've talked to people about all kinds of aspects of the topic, but you bring in the legal aspect, the corruption and the fraudulence of the drug companies, that aspect of it. So I'm thrilled to be able to talk to you. I think you round out our coverage of this topic very nicely. So as people can see, like, you know, with your background, and I'm sure by the way we titled this episode, we are here to talk about the Zyprexa papers and your journey in, you know, acquiring them and understanding them and exposing them. And, you know, as people can see the cover of your book behind you, or I'm holding it here. And it's just, I was reading a bunch of reviews about the book too. People absolutely love it. So congratulations on being able to, you know, accomplish this, like such an important book that people are actually really enjoying reading, that discusses the legalities of the situation in detail, but is also extremely human, as you profile very specific cases of people who were being forcefully drugged. So can we just start with the broad question? What are the Zyprexa papers?
So I was called by an expert witness in a massive litigation over Zyprexa causing diabetes and other metabolic problems that Lilly had hid from the doctors and the public. In fact, lied to the doctors about it. And this expert witness had access to it's called discovery in litigation, you know, where the parties exchange information as required under the court rules. And he had access to this material, but it was under a secrecy order by the court. And the secrecy order said that if he was subpoenaed in another case, he had to give Lilly a reasonable opportunity to object before he turned him over. And he called me to see if I would subpoena him. And I thought Lily would object, and anyway, we'd be off in a court process arguing about it. But they didn't object in time, and the expert, Dr. David Eagleman, sent them to me. And those are the Zyprexa papers, the documents that he sent to me. And I'm actually enjoined from disseminating them by a court order. So, but those are the Zyprexa papers. And they show that not only did Eli Lilly know from the beginning that it caused diabetes and other metabolic problems, but that, and they hid it from the doctors and lied to the doctors when they brought it up, because the doctors were seeing that and seeing massive weight gain in people. People would gain 100 pounds in a year, and not a real small percentage. And they also showed that Lilly was illegally marketing Zyprexa to children, even little children, and the elderly. So those are the Zyprexa papers.
It's truly disgusting. You know, it's, and I think of you as like an American hero. And I'm always so inspired by people who stand up to these behemoth powers in our world in the form of corporations with all the resources they could ever need to protect themselves against exposure or, you know, just criminal cases. And it's just, it's disgusting. It's discouraging. It's very sad to live in a world where profit incentives are more important than a child's health. And I read that, you know, the adverse effect of significant weight gain was particularly pronounced in children, as was, and then there was that adverse effects, and then it causing type 2 diabetes. And let's back up a little bit just to say, for people who don't know, Zyprexa is a psychiatric drug. It is classified, as some people call it, as an antipsychotic, which more accurately, of course, we would describe it as like a neuroleptic, which translates to seize the brain or to seize the nerve. And it's very important to me that we are strict about the type of language that we use so that it's not misleading. And I do believe that it's misleading to call something like Zyprexa, or really any psychiatric drug, to call it a medication. That conjures up the wrong connotation in our minds, I believe. And so I myself hold myself to the standard of strictly describing these as what they really are, which are drugs. And that doesn't mean that I'm wholeheartedly against every drug that has ever been made. Of course not. But psychiatric drugs are particularly harmful to people, and the evidence on that is in. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a drug manufactured by the pharmaceutical company by the name of Eli Lilly. And as many people are aware, you know, the drug company itself conducts a lot of the experiments as the drug is being manufactured and being approved of, and then reports that data. And so in that opportunity to report the data is where some shady business can happen. So my understanding is that they did certain things to, first of all, manipulate the study to increase the likelihood of positive results in the first place. But then even when they got very negative results, evidence of harm, they hid that, correct?
Yes. And that's actually a pretty standard drug company technique.
Yeah. How is that okay? What is your thought about the solution to that? I mean, should experiments always be conducted by independent researchers, or how can we fix that problem?
Well, you know, I think one big problem is that the drug companies pay the FDA to get their drugs approved, you know, and so I think that should change. I think it should be independent researchers. the research used to be done basically by universities, you know, university professors. That doesn't really happen anymore. Mm-hmm. They use these contract research organizations. And if they don't come up, you know, if they don't produce the results that they want, they won't get the next contract. Dr. David Healy, who literally wrote the book on the history of psychopharmacology, he's on a mission now that the actual data from the studies should be available. What the drug companies do is they say, oh, this data from these volunteers who literally risked their lives and, you know, to benefit, you know, everybody. This data is our trade secrets. And so even the authors that the drug companies put on the studies, their names, they are not allowed access to the data. The drug companies write up, you know, the research and give them to the authors, who then basically put their name on it. So all of this, that sort of stuff should be banned. But there should, the data should be available. And actually, Dr. Healy says that should include being able to interview the actual participants in the study. So, for example, one of the things that they do is they put down suicidality as lability, which is,
emotional instability.
It's, you know, a symptom that, I mean, is a, what do I want to, you know, it's a big word, you know, that is used in the profession. And, you know, or they'll put it down as agitation. Even suicide attempts, they'll put down as lability. And so it's really important that the actual participants of the study be accessible to for people to review. I mean, the whole idea of science is that, you know, it's supposed to be legitimately reviewable by people, and yes, these things just are not.
Right. You said a few things there that I think, you know, there are things that someone like you and me have been well aware of. And so when we acknowledge it, it doesn't have that groundbreaking feeling to it of like impact. But I think for some people, when they hear you say the pharmaceutical companies pay the FDA to approve their drugs, some people will be like, what did you just say? That's news to many people. So tell us, what evidence do we have? How do we know that pharmaceutical companies pay the FDA to ensure that their drug gets approved?
Well, there's this whole fee structure. I mean, I think maybe it was in 1994 or something. The FDA used to be funded by, you know, the government and government revenues. And now there's this whole fee structure to get your drugs approved. So there's that. And of course, there's a revolving door between the FDA and the drug company.
Right.
And it's a classic example of a captured agency where the industry that it's supposed to regulate has really been captured by the industry.
And then the other thing that might seem groundbreaking to people is the ghostwriting phenomenon. So just to clarify that really quick for people, what Jim just said about how the drug company will write up the article, and then other researchers who might be well known in the field or associated with universities or just have credibility, their names are put on it. But they didn't actually do the data analysis themselves, and they didn't even choose the language with which they presented that data and wrote the report. So that's just another thing I wanted to clarify for people. And it's just mind-boggling that this is the state of affairs. So, okay, now let's talk a little bit more about how a drug company and how Eli Lilly specifically manipulated the experiment in the first place. I wrote down a few notes, but I remember what you were talking about. So do you remember off the top of your head what some of those ways are that Eli Lilly manipulated the outcomes of the study?
Yeah, the two big ones are what they call placebo washout, which they hijacked that term. I understand there's legitimate uses of that, but basically their control group. There's kind of two combined in this. Their control group were people that they abruptly withdrew from Haldol. Well, we know that when you abruptly stop a neuroleptic, as with most psych drugs, a lot of people will have it will become psychotic as a result. They'll have symptoms, and it's not any underlying mental illness. I mean, what the psychiatrists will say, oh, you tried to stop your drugs. See, your illness, your mental illness is, come back out. But no, it's actually a withdrawal effect. If I can go a little bit. So what the neuroleptics do is they block 70 to 90% of the dopamine in the frontal lobe, the basal ganglia, and the limbic system. And so before I knew this, I thought of the neuroleptics as chemical straitjackets, but actually what they are chemical lobotomies. Yeah. Because they block the, transmission in the frontal lobe. Right. So the brain's response to that, at first, it pumps out more dopamine, to compensate for this blockage. But after a few weeks, the brain kind of gives up on that and then grows more dopamine receptors. And so they've never shown any brain abnormalities in people diagnosed with schizophrenia, until they've been put on the drugs. And then you see all kinds of brain abnormalities, including this one, and shrinkage. I forget in what area, but
the gray matter in the entire cortex. That's I can link a study just for people. I know we publish this on many platforms, and sometimes there's not an option to link studies. But like those who take this in, like on YouTube, for example, I will put the link to the study demonstrating that I forget exactly which neuroleptic it was, but that it caused shrinkage of the cortex. It sounds crazy to say. If someone just says, like, do you know that these drugs can shrink your brain, that person might be dismissed as a conspiracy theorist. Like, no way, that can't be true. But there's legitimate evidence published in reputable journals demonstrating this.
I could go out all these different tangents, but yeah, that just reminds me of one, which is a lot of psychiatric patients or people, especially people that are forced to, they actually know this better, maybe even better than the doctors who basically hide their head in the sand. And when they say that these drugs are harmful to me, that they shrink my, cortex, then that is cited as evidence of their mental illness, that they're delusional. So getting back to the studies. Mm-hmm. So the control group was this group of people who were abruptly withdrawn from Haldol. And so most of them had psychotic reactions to that. And so that was supposedly the neutral control group. And so, just automatically people would, when people put on Zyprexa would look better than those people. Okay, but so that's one of the ways that they did it. Then another one was part of that. Okay, while most people have, symptoms that from the withdrawal, some people actually do quite well when they come off of, Haldol abruptly. Well, they threw them out of the study. They called that placebo washout, and that's why I say they hijacked that term. So that was one. So that's kind of two. And then the third one was what's called last observation carried forward, where Zyprexa is just so awful, is experienced as so awful and unhelpful that high percentages of people just dropped out of the study because they couldn't make people stay in them. Unlike, my world, the psych rights world, people were forced to take them. So they got thrown out. They withdrew from the study. So then what they decided was, well, we'll just assume that whatever status they were in when they withdrew is the status they would be in at the end of the study. Well, what's the point of doing a 12-week study if you're going to assume that the person at 2 weeks is going to be the same at 12 weeks? So those are the three main ones.
Yes. Good memory. That's exactly what you wrote about. The so-called non-compliance, the discontinuation of the drug within the study, that's so consistent, you know, across various trials. Famously, in the early 2000s, was the CATIE studies. This is something I know we're both aware of, and this is something that was written about in Robert Whitaker's books, at least The Anatomy of an Epidemic. And so anyway, this is the Clinical Antipsychotic Trials of Intervention Effectiveness, which was funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. And it attempted to compare the first sort of generation and the second generation of these so-called antipsychotic drugs. And then in their attempts to compare them, all kinds of other things came to light, like the adverse effects of them, and above all, the intolerable nature of them. And the numbers, I was just double checking. So there were 1,460 participants enrolled in the study, and 74% of them discontinued the drug before the 18-month study was over. And there were various drugs being tested, of course. I mentioned they were being compared, but Zyprexa was one of them. And the numbers for how many people discontinued Zyprexa was in the high 60%. And then there were others that were in the 80s. So yeah, this is just a major, that to me was the most major finding of the study. It wasn't presented as the most major finding, but to me, that was what stood out as being most significant. Okay.
Yeah, and remember that these drugs are being forced into people. I mean, if under court orders, and some people actually resist to the point where they get basically held down by four people and injected with it. And think about that person who knows this drug is harmful to them, and that they are being held down and injected with it. It's just an abomination.
It's almost too evil to be believable. And I do think that some people actually knowingly or unknowingly are in disbelief. There is almost a cultural denial about it that I observe. And part of that denial is based in, like, there's no way this could be true. It's too evil to be believable. But I like to point out, you know, not to appeal to authority here, but the people that I'm bringing on this podcast, these are very serious people. You know, you are a Harvard trained lawyer. You know, my recent conversation was with a Stanford psychiatrist. And you know, again, that doesn't really make your argument stronger because you're a Harvard trained lawyer. Like, we're not appealing to authority, but the point I'm making is seriously smart people who are very well trained in their craft are taking the position that, you know, you're taking, are exposing how unbelievably evil. I mean, I know it's a strange word to use, and I don't mean it in any kind of like religious way. I just mean in knowingly harmful. It's a knowingly harmful practice that people are continuing to carry out.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, well, one thing is that you said you're not, appealing to authority, but that's basically how this is perpetrated, is you have the psychiatric profession, which are supposed to be the experts on this, who are presenting this false narrative. And people really have the right to believe the so-called experts and authorities. And so it's just a complete betrayal of trust for them to use that position to perpetrate these lies, basically in pursuit of money.
Right. I'm glad you said that, because if that wasn't obvious to people who are listening, that is, of course, the driving force behind all of this. And Zyprexa was indeed an extreme moneymaker for Eli Lilly, even when you factor in the cost of doing business, which is the settlements that they paid out. And Zyprexa, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but I'll still mention this, that in 2009, Zyprexa had to pay a $1.4 billion settlement out in criminal fees and to the people who were harmed by the drug. And that,
if I might say so, it was reported that investigation gained momentum because of the release of the Zyprexa paper. It had been under seal for 5 years before that. And then the Zyprexa papers came out in the, you know, front page of the New York Times, and that got the Department of Justice moving, according to this report, which, you know, is almost certainly accurate.
Right. I believe that. Well, let's go there. Let's kind of go back to 2006, 2007, which 2006 is when you were initially contacted, right?
Right. The end of
and you obtained the Zyprexa papers. And then please tell us the story that led to, you know, all the New York Times publications. I'll read off some of those titles and just kind of what you experienced. And I know there's probably the many versions of the story at different lengths, whatever you feel compelled to share right now from that point in time.
Well, first off, I mentioned before about Dr. Eagleman calling me, you know, asking if I would subpoena him. And you can't, and I, you know, I was interested because I had my own reasons for wanting to, you know, get this information out. And, but you can't just subpoena something, you need to have a case. So I had to, you know, find an appropriate case. Mm-hmm. And in Alaska, these forced drugging proceedings are secret. I mean, they are so secret. And so I went out to the hospital and I handed out flyers to people to say, you know, I'm willing to represent, mm-hmm. you know, your loved one in a forced drugging hearing. And then the Assistant Attorney General wrote me a letter, you know, banning me and then saying that I was violating professional ethics and all that. So that was a little bit of an adventure all in itself. But I found Bill Bigley, who I represented, and I read quite a bit about him. I had a lot of cases with him. So then I had got the case, and then I subpoenaed the documents, and I'll just tell this one little vignette. Okay, so the subpoena goes out, and a few days later, I get a call from this lawyer who on my voicemail, and says, "Oh, I'm representing Eli Lilly," and I didn't really want to talk to him, but I didn't really want to act, you know, look like I didn't want to talk to him. So I called up Eagleman and said, "Oh, they're on to us." And then I thought, well, it was right at the end of the day. So I'll call him at 8 a.m. and he might not be there, and then leave voicemail. And, that way, he can't say, you know, I was avoiding him. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure Eli Lilly knew that happened, because in between that time and the time they whistled up the federal judges, the papers got out and New York Times article. Well, actually, it happened at the same time. So anyway, that was a Wednesday. On Friday, this special discovery master in the big Zyprexa case left me a voicemail and said, "Oh, I heard you got these documents. I'm a special discovery master. Please give me a call. I'll be available all weekend." And then 2 hours later, I got this order from him telling me to stop disseminating them and to return them. Basically. And so it's like, well, what is this guy? How does this guy get to order me about? Mm-hmm. And, so anyway, so then, whistled up this federal judge, and well, first this magistrate judge, who was, they were all, the judges were all pretty irritated at me. And I felt I was strictly following the secrecy order, what the judge, you know, signed that order. Mm-hmm. And that it was Dr. Eagleman's actual responsibility to follow it. I mean, what, you know, I hadn't signed it. So at one point, this magistrate judge asked me, "Don't you think you had the obligation to tell Lily?" And I said, "No." So anyway, then the legendary U.S. District Court Judge Jack Weinstein, who passed away, I think, almost 2 years ago now. He was 84 or something at the time. He was in Antarctica, and when he came back, he started setting up. He set up this hearing, but I was enjoined from disseminating them, and this previously to his final order websites, you know, they enjoined the internet from disseminating, which, you know, he didn't have the power to do that. But by then I had given them to this person, but this great guy by the name of Will Hall, and said, "Can you get them out on the internet in a way that they, you know, aren't traceable and can't be gotten back?" And he did. He did. And so, so then on December 18th, I think the subpoena went out on December 11th. I got them on the 6th. I got the call from the Eli lawyer on the 11th of December. I got the documents in and out on the 12th, and the New York Times article appeared that Sunday, December 18th.
Mm-hmm.
Eli Lilly, you know, was slow off the mark, but I knew they would be big and fast once they got going. So that's why I tried to get them out in a way that couldn't be gotten back. Mm.
And you believed that the public had a right to know this information?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. I mean, of course they do.
Right. Of course, indeed. It's shocking that there were people who were fighting against the public knowing that information. And so I'm just curious, what exactly, in what form do these documents exist? I'm realizing this moment, I haven't looked at the documents myself. I've only read about them. So, you know, because what I imagine is, like, you know, the format of an academic paper, but it wasn't an academic paper that had been published. So what did it look like exactly?
So again, I'm enjoined from disseminating them. Mm-hmm. So I can't, I interpret that to not even saying whether they're still available on the internet, but just going from the New York Times articles, mm-hmm. for example. So there were emails back and forth, and there were internal presentations, you know, to Eli Lilly, you know, sales staff and research people. I mean, there's an email from one of their, might have been a contract doctor or something, but maybe an employee. But anyway, he said, "We've got to come clean on this diabetes stuff." And of course they did. Mm-hmm. So a lot of emails.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a case in Alaska versus Eli Lilly, and there were a lot of call notes between the sales, you know, of the sales reps, you know, calling on customers, but I'm not sure those were in the Zyprex papers. And I, you know, I actually didn't read that many of them because I got them and then made sure I got them right out.
Right.
And then I got ordered to return them pretty quickly.
Right. That makes sense. Well, and I'll just in case people are curious, I'll read off just some of the titles of the articles that were published in the New York Times starting on that Sunday in December of 2006, which the first one was entitled, "Eli Lilly Said to Play Down risk of top pill. And then, you know, these are not particularly in order, but all with kind of within that year, another one comes out called Mother Wonders If Psychosis Drug Helped Kill Son, which is about Zyprexa. There's, you know, U.S. Drug Agency investigating accuracy of Lilly's Zyprexa data. Lilly settles with 18,000 over Zyprexa. Lilly adds strong warning label to Zyprexa, et cetera. These were just some of the articles that in that series that went out over the course of that year or so. And so, you know, to me, I have these thoughts sometimes of like, This is in plain sight, you know, and it's not easy to understand exactly how people are still being prescribed Zyprexa. This is, you know, if you just Google the drug, it just looks like any other drug. And it's not like the first result is not this drug based on fraudulent data and the company misleading people. It's not about that. It's just, you know, the profile of the drug that comes up, the WebMD site that explains its effects. And it's just, so it's not necessarily easy to find if you don't dig at all, but it doesn't take much digging at all. And we have the New York Times exposing this. So it's in plain sight. You know, anyone who wants to understand the true nature of this can. But then again, it makes you wonder, what else has been covered up? What is currently being covered up? If not for you and the people involved in exposing this, would it ever have come to light? So that's kind of, in some sense,
I don't think so. Yeah. Frankly, I don't think so.
Wow. Do you feel?
Well, I should say until it came off patent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right. and that's really quite the pattern, is that the drug companies hide all these harms. And then they try and develop a substitute drug that they can charge more for. And the patent, which what that does is allow them to charge monopoly prices.
Right.
And so then once they come off patent and can no longer charge monopoly prices and generics, come out, mm-hmm. then all of a sudden the harms of, these drugs come out. And mm-hmm. I don't take any prescription drugs, but I mean, my attitude is you probably shouldn't take any drug that is still on patent because you don't really know about them. I mean, that might not be true for some of the new cancer drugs, but even those, I mean, the same sort of things go on.
I see why you say that. Yeah, that makes sense. And can you clarify, do you know off the top of your head, how long the patent lasts now? Is it 10 years, 20 years?
No, 18, I think. It's 18, okay. I think 18.
Okay. Right. And I think people totally understood what you're saying, but just to highlight that, you can charge monopoly prices if you have a patent on a drug because generics can't be made, and so you're the only one who has it. And then coincidentally enough, that's always the one that tends to get prescribed the most. What do you know? Okay. Well, tell me what then happened in your life? And I know that you were already, thanks to personal experience and other reasons, you were already advocating for patients prior to obtaining these documents. Like you started Psych Rights and you might need to clarify this for me too. I know it's a website, of course, psychrights.org. Is it also a law firm who specializes in defending people against forced drugging?
So yeah, the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights, Psych Rights, is a public interest law firm whose mission is to mount a strategic litigation campaign against forced psychiatric drugging and electroshock. So yes, but I never really built up the capacity of it. So it was, in terms of the legal stuff, it was mostly just me, and I've gotten too old to really do that anymore. I write in the book about my cases with Bill Bibley, and these cases, typically the hospital files a petition. The psychiatric voluntarily imprison someone, which is euphemistically called involuntary commitment, and drug them against their will in the morning, and then want the hearing, the trial on it, to get the court order that afternoon. So that's, you know, I mean, first off, that makes the legal proceeding a farce in and of itself. Mm-hmm. You can't possibly present a good defense, you know, any kind of defense in that time frame. And so whenever I would talk to a client about possibly representing them, I would tell them, look, I have to have at least a couple days to try and put together a defense. And but even with that, I mean, the statute only allows it to be delayed up to, I think, 7 days for the initial commitment, because they don't want the lawyers to keep putting things off and have their clients languish in the you know, hospital while the lawyer's not, not trying to get them out. But right. But the result is there's no real defense put up. Mm-hmm. But even with that, so even I get a couple of days, so it's really fast. I mean, a really short time frame. And that really takes a toll, and I'm just not really up to it anymore. And I have issues with, you know, I was in a psych hospital myself for 30 days in 1982, and it's all about not getting sleep. And so I'm not really doing that anymore. But we were, and we won 5 Alaska Supreme Court cases, and a case in the 7th United States Court of Appeals.
That's amazing. So tell us, what a two-part question. What is the justification, I suppose, like in the eyes of the court, for forcefully drugging people? And what is the argument against that?
Well, the statute in Alaska, until I got it changed this past session, but at the time the statute said if someone is incompetent to decline the medication, then the hospital gets to do whatever it wants. That's what the statute said. And I said, hey, wait a minute. Under the Constitution, you have to at least prove that it's in the person's best interest, and there's no less intrusive alternative. And that's what the Supreme Court said. That's what the Supreme Court ruled in the Myers case. And then there was a Bigley case later that kind of expanded on that. And Alaska Supreme Court case. So they agreed. So that's the defense against it, is you have to prove it's in someone's best interest by clear and convincing evidence. And that means that it's highly probable. I mean, interestingly, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a case where someone said, well, you're trying to lock me up in, you know, like in a prison, so you should have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And the Supreme Court said, well, psychiatrists could never prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. So we'll just say clear and convincing. So they have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that it's in the person's best interest. Well, I think, I mean, if someone, an adult, not children, if an adult wants to take them, I think they should be told the truth about them. But even if not, if they want to take them, That I have no objection to that. But they should, you know, if someone's forced to take it, no. And I don't think it can ever legitimately be proven that it's in the person's best interest to force drug someone against their will, because if you're put on a neuroleptic and stay on it, your chance of recovering is 5 or 6%. Now, there are programs that have been squashed, but they're coming back, kind of like Soteria House and the open dialogue approach, hearing voices, healing homes, those kind of things. But Soteria and open dialogues in particular have shown that you can have an 80% recovery rate. Okay. And then if you're, So first off, so how can you prove that's in the person's best interest? Then there was this other study by the National Association of Mental Health Providers, or no, Mental Health Directors, something like that. But it's they showed that people in the public mental health system who are diagnosed with serious mental illness have a 25-year shorter lifespan. And this is almost all as a result of the drugs. I mean, Dr. David Healy did a study, I think, in Scotland back in the, well, there's a lot of evidence that they reduce people's lives. But it used to be that people that would have comparable diagnoses, say, at the beginning in the 1900s, they had comparable lifespans with everybody else. And now it's 20, 25 years earlier. So how can you prove that that's in someone's best interest? Well, in one of the Bigley cases that I did, I proved that. I mean, I had Dr. Grace Jackson, who wrote the report on Zyprexa that ended up that caused Dr. David Eagleman to call me. She said that Bill Bigley would be dead within 5 years if they kept drugging him. And so then his guardian testified, well, it's not necessarily the quantity of his life that matters. It's the quality of his life.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. And but Bill's idea, I mean, what Bill felt was the quality of his life, you know, what was better for him, that was irrelevant.
Mm.
And then, okay, and then the judge ordered him to be drugged, saying, well, even if it shortens his life, Bill's not doing well now and he's getting worse. And so he ordered him to be drugged against his will. And then I was shortly after that prohibited from representing Bill.
Stunning. How is a person deemed to be incompetent in the eyes of the court?
Well, that's kind of a farce in itself. I mean, I could kind of pull up the statute, but I won't. But basically, you know, to be able to appreciate the benefits and risks of the drug, and, you know, and then one of the, in a statute in Alaska, it says, denying that you have denying that you have a mental illness when there's, you know, evidence that you are, is a factor in proving that you're incompetent. There's like four or five factors, but it's basically that. I mean, in the Faith Myers case, and the testimony, her testimony is on the PsychRights website. She goes through chapter and verse about why she didn't want to take the drugs. I mean, she was a single mother with a couple of kids, and she's working, I think, and ran a daycare, maybe even owned a daycare. But she was having some trouble, and she was put on Novane, which is in the same class as Thorazine and Haldol, or maybe not as strong, for like 20 years. And then she came to Alaska, and they said, oh my God, you're going to get tardive dyskinesia, because everybody gets tardive dyskinesia almost if they're on it long enough. And so we want to put you on Risperdal. And then she, for the first time in her life, she started having voices and hallucinations. She red lights, you know, green lights look like red lights, look like green lights, and stuff like that. And so, and she testified to this, and the judge still found her incompetent. So basically my take on it is the judges don't want to be blamed if something goes wrong. And so they're going to go along with the doctors. And one of the things that I decided is, if you can get a jury trial, do it, because a jury trial is, you're much more likely to win, because the juries actually take the, you know, their instructions seriously. Mm-hmm. Where the judges, you know, the judges says, oh, you have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the person is a serious danger to self or others in the relatively near future. They don't really care about that. And if the doctor says they want locked up, they'll locked up. And by the way, psychiatrists are notoriously unreliable in predicting violence. I mean, there have been studies on this, and it's no better than chance. Mm-hmm. Well, 50-50 is not clear and convincing. Right. So, you know, so basically we need to be doing other things, and there are other things that have been proven to be very effective for, like I said, up to 80% of people experiencing their first kind of extreme state or psychosis or whatever you want to call it.
And that's the argument against forced drugging, is the fact that there are things that are in the client's better interest.
Right. And locking them up. I mean, fundamentally, the psychiatrists have been given the task to get out of the way disturbing people. I mean, basically, right, these people are disturbing other people.
Right.
And so, you know, that you put this idea that, oh, we're trying to help them, but it's really an excuse to get people out of the way so they're not disturbing people. And the drugs are designed to clamp down on people so they're not able to disturb other people.
Mm. Exactly. That's the truth. And I mean, of course, that's something that Thomas Sasse was saying a long time ago, that the question of who are we really helping when we drug people? And the answer is ourselves. We are benefiting ourselves. And the benefit is that we don't have to deal with these people. We don't have to be made to feel uncomfortable by somebody who's acting abnormally. And so it's true. We're just making things easier on ourselves, and ourselves in this case being anyone who's not, you know, exhibiting these types of atypical behaviors. So, and it makes me think too about, you know, it's an interesting thought experiment. What if there were no drugs? What would we do? And we had to get really, like, we had to problem solve, and we would, and it wasn't an option to resort to drugs, and it wasn't an option to incarcerate people who make us uncomfortable either. I'll have that thought experiment more on my own. And I encourage people who are listening now to engage in that thought experiment, you know, and the truth is, yeah, we might get desperate, but what would we do in that desperation? How creatively would we begin to think? How willing would we be to dramatically change aspects of society and aspects of our community? And how much more, you know, effective would our solutions be if we didn't have this go-to resort of
we have the answer. I mean, we have some answers for that. I mean, soteria houses, for example, but in open dialogue, I mean, they literally virtually eliminated schizophrenia in that part of Lapland, Finland. Because in order to get the diagnosis, you've got to have those symptoms for 6 months. And so they have this approach, it's called open dialogue. And what they do is they have a team, and they bring in everybody in that person's life with the person. It's always with the person. And they think of the problem as not really being with the person, but in the space between the people. Mm-hmm. And they just work things out. I mean, and so people have had experience, you know. I mean, there's some physical things that happen.
Sure.
I mean, you know, some maybe drug reactions or Lyme disease or something like that. But if you're talking about real psychiatric conditions, something or things usually in my sense of, in talking to people, is people will say there's things that happened to them in their, when they were children, lots of times abuse, physical and or sex, you know, or including sexual abuse, you know, other things that happened that set them up for it. And then there was something that, you know, put them over the edge. Mm-hmm. And so you, I mean, one of the things that the mental health system doesn't do is ask the person what they want. What would you like us to do? I mean, how can we help you? And so that's one thing. And the soteria model, the basic mantra there is to be with someone rather than do to them, but nothing forced. I mean, if it's one of the sayings in the, you know, in the psychiatric survivor movement or the mental health consumer movement, is nothing about us without us. Don't, you know, you need to involve the person and, you know, whatever, whatever's going on. And so there are known things to do. And it's, these things have been known for a long time. There's tremendous amount of good work going on, especially in the 70s, basically. Jay Haley, you know, Lauren Moser, Gregory Bates, I mean, before that, I guess. And then the psychopharmaceutical juggernaut just crushed all of this, you know, other work that was going on.
You're right. I thank you for saying that, too, because I don't mean to frame this thought experiment as like, on the idea that no one has had this thought experiment and that we're starting from ground zero, because you're absolutely right. People have had this thought experiment and have taken action in implementing solutions and creating programs. I wasn't aware of the Open Dialogue program, so I'm really glad you've put that on my radar, and I'm going to learn a lot more about that. And I love that phrase, nothing about us without us. I feel like that could apply to a lot of marginalized communities. For whom other people are making decisions. That's great. And even that term itself, psychiatric survivor, you know, that's a term we've talked about on this podcast in different episodes. We interviewed somebody who is a psychiatric survivor, and we talked to Dr. Peter Gutsche, who really, I don't know if he coined the term, but he made it more famous. And so in any case, that in itself says a lot about psychiatry, that people believe they have survived it if they, you know, have come out of it and feeling like, okay, if they were, that you have to recover from this.
Yeah, that you have to survive psychiatry. Yeah. And a lot of people don't. I mean, there's
a lot of people don't.
And it wasn't Dr. Gutsche. I mean, that phrase has been around for a long time, okay. But maybe he's publicizing, but there's, this kind of C/S/X. So it's like mental health consumers, psychiatric survivors, and ex patients. And they're very, you know, that's kind of the three categories that people, you know, think of themselves as being in, but mostly either in the US, a mental health consumer or a psychiatric survivor. And, yeah, I mean, this has been going on really since, I mean, forever, for centuries, really. But there was a reemergence in the 1970s in this really influential book called On Our Own, On Our Own, Patient-Driven Alternatives to Psychiatry by Judy Chamberlain, J-U-D-I. And so there was this whole movement that it was pretty active in the 70s and 80s, and then it was kind of, in some ways, co-opted. Just like right now, there's this big push for, you know, peer support, because people who have the lived experience of having been locked up or psychiatrically imprisoned and maybe drugged against their will really have an ability to relate and connect to people who are experiencing it now in ways that I wouldn't say no one else can, but it's just something that allows people to connect. And but that whole movement is being co-opted and corrupted to a pretty large extent, where they hire quote peers to enforce medication compliance, you know, medication compliance. But there's a whole, you know, approach and philosophy about what peer support is supposed to be. And there's this program called Intentional Peer Support. They have trainings and stuff. And it's really interesting and really good. And one of the things is it's non-hierarchical. The other thing is you validate the person's experience, you know. You ask them what they want. Those kind of, I mean, that's not even on the table in the current psychiatric system, especially the coercive system, to ask the person what they want, ask the person what they would find, you know, helpful. So, I mean, there's Dr. Gerchen is going to publish this study of cases in Alaska. I already did one in Denmark. And one of the things was, you know, the patients would say, well, I've had really bad experience on drug A, but I've done okay. I'd be willing to take drug B. And the psychiatrist says, well, I like drug A better. And the court orders drug A. I mean, it's just nuts, really. I mean, I think the psychiatric system is nuts.
Nuts. Insane. And there was a part in your book where you wrote that you kind of felt like for a while there was, I forget how you put it exactly, but the thing that really kind of hit me was you felt like things were kind of reverting back to normal. That there was all this awareness of these, you know, these drug companies paying out these settlements and fraudulent practices. And yet you feared that it was just kind of going to blow over and things would go back to normal business.
Or that they had, yeah.
That they already had, right? So what is your vision of the future? If you're trying to predict it, I'll ask you, what do you predict will happen? And then what do you hope will happen?
So getting to that, so that was specifically about when settlements that the drug companies always demand that all the, you know, all the information that was discovered during the litigation has to be kept secret, that the victims have to agree to keep it secret. And after the Zyprexa papers came out, there was a short period of time where the lawyers tended not to do that. I mean, I could go into, I write, you know, some length about that in the book of the reasons for it and all that. And for a short period of time, I think these documents were coming out, but not anymore. Right. I mean, the drug companies insist and the lawyers say, well, if you want to get any money, you're going to have to agree to that. And of course, that the lawyers are going to get any money. They have to get their clients to agree to it. Where do I see things going? I mean, I see it as a titanic battle, and the drug companies and psychiatry are winning. My main focus right now is on trying to get some of these alternative approaches actually going. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a Soteria House in Vermont. I got one going or helped get one going in Alaska, but it ran for about 6 years or so and then kind of lost support, funding, et cetera. And it closed. There's in Israel, I've got different reports about it, but at least half a dozen Soteria houses and the guy who created them, Pesach Lichtenberg, he bristles at the idea that, you know, when you say, oh, the alternatives, he says, no, this is part of the system in Israel. So, and it's not strictly, you know, like the original Soteria house, and they actually will refer people to get you know, locked up if they can't have them. Which never, I don't think it ever happened at the original Soterios. Maybe it did. Anyways, you know, some people are, you know, you have to do something. But my view on that, you asked about that before, is, you know what? We don't lock gang members up because we think they're going to commit a crime. If someone is committing a crime, okay. But if not, don't lock them up. And I think this idea of being with someone instead of doing to them is the key. So in any event, so peer respites are relatively short, term residential places, where depending on the places, maybe 7 or 10 days, where people who are kind of going into crisis can go into, and they're run by peers and they have these principles. And I've done 3 short videos for the International Peer Respite / Soterios Summit. And one of them is called How Afia House AFIYA Helped Me. And it's on YouTube. And this woman describes about how much it helped her. And so, like, for example, they asked her, well, was there anything in the hospital that you found helpful? And she said, well, I don't really like my answer, but if I was locked in my room for a few days, that would really help. And so what the peer respite people said is, well, we have locks on our doors, but they're on the inside. And if you want to, you know, lock yourself in your room, you know, that's fine. And that sort of thing. I mean, it's a whole different approach. Mm-hmm. And it's really validating people's experience and asking them what they want.
Yes. You know? I appreciate that you're emphasizing that and the fact that that never happens in the psychiatric system. And it just totally is, it's obvious that that's based on the fundamental belief that this person doesn't know what is best for them, and
even what they want. I mean, in the biblical cases. Okay, so I mean, Bill, by the time he died, he had been psychiatrically imprisoned about 100 times, and one of the people came in and said, "Bill says he wants to go to Cuba, but he doesn't really know what he wants." Well, it made perfect sense for him to want to get the hell out of there. And, you know, I mean, it's just once you have this idea that people have misfiring neurons in their brains and it's, you know, just these random incorrect thoughts, then everything, you know, which is totally untrue, then that means that everything they say is just completely discredited as the ravings of a lunatic.
Right. That's something I've thought a lot about, is what happens to the perception of somebody who's been diagnosed with a mental disorder, and specifically what happens in the eyes of the person diagnosing them, the physician diagnosing them. How does their perception then shift? And number one, what you're saying, they are now perceived as a raving lunatic, and any form of expression, verbal, behavioral, anything, can easily be framed as a symptom, an expression of their flaw, their illness, their disorder. And then the other thing that I find is when a person has been diagnosed with a condition, they are now seen in this with a very blunted perception. There's no more subtlety to the perception of that person's individuality, because now they're just a schizophrenic, and there's this very, it blunts the perception of anyone who either diagnoses them or just knows that they have that diagnosis. Even they just see them as, like, you know, this general type of person, and that then they then fail to appreciate the person's complexity and individuality. But again, also, yeah, what you're saying, you know, that if they say something that is even faintly close to outside the norm, well, yeah, they're just a lunatic. And the idea too that they don't even know what they want. I appreciate you catching the distinction there between what I said and what you were saying. I was saying we might assume they don't know what they need or what's best for them. And that's one thing. But to assume that they don't even know what they want, that's quite another, you know, because I want things all the time that are not best for me. And if someone were to tell me, like, you can't have that because I say so, or you don't even really know what you want, that would be a profound violation of my freedom as a human being. And that's that this goes that deep, you know, to the level of like, this is existential, you know, that we are violating people's freedom to exist in the way they want to exist, even if it's not harming anyone else. Yeah, it's a deep, deep problem with a lot of philosophical underpinnings.
Indeed.
Has anyone ever approached you about making a movie out of what you went through?
So I've always felt it was a movie. And I think that the movie jumps out of the book. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. It seems like an ask for you, and people have, and I've tried to pursue it. And I actually met with a producer, I don't know, about a month ago, but didn't really work out. I think it's a movie, and you know, I'm very proud of the book, and I think if it got wider exposure, you know, that it could have, you know, pretty good impact. But people don't read books that much anymore. Yeah. And so I think a movie would be, you know, a good movie would be, you know, maybe have a beneficial impact. So I'm pursuing it. A lot of people have suggested it, just no producers.
Mm. Yeah. And in my opinion, too, a movie or a series might even be better, because there's enough here to do like an 8-part series or something and really track it and get to know the characters. And so if when I think about that, I think about like, well, who, you know, who would play you and how would they depict you? So I'm curious to know, if such a series or movie was made, what type of emotions would the actor playing you have to embody to accurately reflect what you were going through? In other words, what did you go through emotionally?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I could describe it that way. I mean, I could, you know, say, oh, Tom Hanks should play me and Steve Spielberg should, you know, direct it.
Yeah,
or produce it. Someone suggested Mark Ruffalo, but you know, I don't know. I feel like I come, you know, my emotions come through, and you know what I was going through come through in the book. But how would I describe it? I mean, it was certainly scary. I was certainly, you know, determined to, you know, get this stuff out. And then I, you know, tried really hard to. I kind of think of it as guerrilla litigation, because it kind of happened to Eli Lilly before they knew they even had a problem. And then then it was to try and minimize the, the negative consequences to me. And I feel like I, you know, really escaped any serious adverse effects. I mean, I think, you know, that I'm pretty self-reflective in the book. I mean, you know, I say I screwed up here, I screwed up there. I never should have believed that Eli Lilly was going to follow through on its promise, during settlement negotiations. They just used it to get past the Alaska v. Lilly trial without, you know, me making a fuss. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you tell me,
yeah,
what the emotion should be.
Well, yeah, it's case. I like what you said, you know, that I would be scared too, that's for sure. And I could tell up against a giant like Eli Lilly and threatening to have your, what's the word for it? Your bar
Disbarred.
disbarred. Thank you.
Yeah. And then threatened me with criminal contempt.
Yeah, that's so scary.
And the judge ruled that I had, quote, conspired to steal these documents. And so, steal, that's criminal.
Right.
So, but they, anyway, but that neither of those things happened.
Right. And your determination comes through definitely. I know I said it in the beginning, but the definition of a hero is someone who's willing to help others, specifically when they're putting themselves at risk to do so. And by that definition, Jim, you are a hero. I truly consider you to be a hero, and I just feel like you're one of the people who will go down in history as a key figure in the change that hopefully completely takes place regarding, mental health care. So from the bottom of my heart and on behalf of so many people, thank you for what you've chosen to do with your professional life. It means so much. And we obviously, you've already literally saved people's lives. And who knows, it's unfathomable what the positive impact really is as it ripples into the future. So again, from the bottom of my heart, on behalf of so many people, thank you so much.
You're very kind.
I mean it. I mean every word of it. It's people like, because I think there's so many people who feel like they're educated about the topic, but they're not in positions to be able to enact change. And so when we see people who have all the qualifications, who are in the right systems, who are in position to make change, and they do, then it's just, I feel like, you represent so many people who want to. So yeah, you're definitely one of those people. Well, I have enjoyed this conversation very much, and I genuinely hope a series comes out about this. But if, meanwhile, I recommend people read Zyprexa papers, get to know the individuals that you have defended, and get to know the story, and get to know the rot at the center of drug companies, at least sometimes. And yeah, get to know this monumental story. It's a great read.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we are connected, and I trust we'll stay connected. But for now, we'll go ahead and end this podcast episode. So thank you to all the listeners. I say this often at the end of conversations, that those of you who are still listening, you're who this is really for. we really value the audience who, has the time and the capacity and the will to listen to these long form conversations. So big shout out to the Psychology is audience. And again, thank you, Jim. We will stay connected.
You bet. My pleasure.